Welcome to the Everything is a Primary Source podcast, the program where history is learned through pop culture. I'm Eric, and I'll be your guide as we travel through time using irregular documents from the past to map our way. Presidents have a strong relationship with popular culture. They get elected, at least in part, by a popular vote, and they tend to be the one person in the whole country that everyone can name. Early December may seem like an odd time to discuss presidential pop culture, but the specific items selected at various podcast karaoke events do have linkage to this time of year. First up is Jade, who spoke to me at Portsmouth, New Hampshire's 400th anniversary celebration in June. It was some footage of the 1905 Portsmouth Peace Treaty ceremony from the Library of Congress, which caught Jade's eye and produced this conversation. President Theodore Roosevelt had orchestrated the conference and won the Nobel Peace Prize on December 10th, 1906.
How's your day going so far?
My day so far is going pretty well. Basically, I've just been hanging out at the Chatterfest with my mom and dad.
Did you see any of the parade at all?
I saw a little bit of the parade. My mom was in it temporarily, so that was fun.
A grand parade. I see that mom's wearing a hat that looks like it belongs in a parade. So that's
yeah.
It was a grand parade for sure. I'm glad I got to take a look at it. But you saw from my table. I have a video going of just various Portsmouth pop culture artifacts, and I would consider something like a peace treaty in 1905 to be popular culture, but you gave me something even more specific than that you would like to talk about. What is one of the products of that peace treaty?
So one of the products of that peace treaty, which is the 1905 Russo-Japanese peace treaty signed in Portsmouth, is that after the peace treaty, the Japanese gave Portsmouth some cherry blossom trees afterwards. And so Portsmouth decided to plant those, and those cherry blossom trees come directly as a product of that treaty. Another interesting thing about this is that Portsmouth now also has a sister city in a town in Japan called Nichinan. And funnily enough, one of the sushi restaurants here is named after that town.
Nice. So I'm glad you brought that up, because I knew that there is a sister city in Japan. I just didn't know the exact name of it. So I'm glad you do. And it sounds like you know your way around Japanese culture and Japanese language quite a bit.
A little bit. I'm studying Japanese right now in school as my second language. So it's really fun for me.
So do you think that without that, because it wasn't random that Theodore Roosevelt wanted Portsmouth to be the setting for the peace treaty at all. But do you think that had it not been for that, would we have had any kind of connection with Japan? Or do you think...
I don't necessarily think that we would have had that same amount of connection with Japan, because with that peace treaty, the way that I actually heard about my teacher knowing about Portsmouth, as she's from Japan, from Osaka, the only way that she knew Portsmouth was because of this peace treaty. And it was taught that Portsmouth was actually a city in the U.S. because of that. So Japan might not have known necessarily about our city of Portsmouth if it wasn't for that treaty.
That's true. And because we're an Atlantic coast city, it's really not, you know, like Japanese merchants and things would be more familiar with the West Coast, you know, because that's obviously closer. So that's an interesting point. Now, when it comes to the trees themselves, the question I chose is, who's the intended user or audience of the trees? It's probably not the actual generation. So how long after the treaty did the trees get gifted over to the city?
I'm actually not sure about that answer. I don't know how long after the treaty it was gifted, but I do feel like the audience of the treaty is more like an audience on the world, like all across the world, to say there has been this treaty. If either side does not follow through on this treaty, then the war might start back again.
Right, right. And a lot of times that war is referred to as World War Zero. Because it was like, it had a lot of elements that would come just not, you know, 10 years later, you know, in the World Wars. And it is, but it flies a lot under our radar nowadays, or I guess in a lot of history, because it didn't involve the United States directly. We were just the setting for the peace treaty. And it fits perfectly into what President Roosevelt wanted to do at the time. And one of the biggest misconceptions that he didn't come to Portsmouth at all for that. You know, I always thought that he was actually present for it, but I remember learning, no, he didn't come here at all. But he arranged for it to happen, and that was on purpose, because he wanted the United States, he wanted to take any possible opportunity he could get to put the United States at the same level as the other empires of the world.
Yeah, it's a sort of form of globalization and the forming of a U.S. empire-like state. And it's very interesting how that sort of started taking place with Theodore Roosevelt and how it just continued on further.
Yeah.
And also that has to do with the occupation of like American Samoa and also Puerto Rico and multiple other places. It's basically just American expansion into the international world and wanting to be seen as a major power, just like Great Britain was.
It's almost like the express version of that, you know. Well, in a way, because I guess the British Empire had been around for, well, we're a product of the British Empire, you know, this part of the country anyway. It had been around for, you know, quite a while by the time you get to the 20th century. And if anything, it was kind of receding a little bit in that era. And it seemed like that was the opportunity for the United States to very rapidly become, like, I always think about, there's that Mark Twain short story called "To the Person Who Sits in Darkness." I don't know if you've read that, where it describes the imperial powers as like sitting at a poker game. And, you know, Britain's there, Germany's there, France is there, and then the United States is there, and they kind of, you know, they pull the chair out, like, come on, you know, sit down with us, because, you know, the Spanish-American War, which Roosevelt, he basically started that war and then volunteered to go fight in it, for all intents and purposes, was the baptism of the country as an empire. Almost, and you mentioned Puerto Rico as being one of the products of that, and it's like, some of the, as president, him organizing the treaty and then having relations with countries as far away as Japan for city of Portsmouth was just like a way to further galvanize, like, you know, which side of the debate he was on, right? When it came to imperialism versus anti-imperialism.
Yeah, very much more on the side of like more imperialistic tendencies, but still anti-imperialist in some senses.
Yeah, well, he kind of wanted to make the United States, I mean, he definitely agreed with the idea of almost like a Hamiltonian style, like, we're going to be a great power, but on our terms, not based on what the rest of the world wants us to be.
Exactly.
When it comes to those trees, those being planted, when, you know, a lot of these trees that we're around right now were intentionally planted. They're not naturally occurring. This park was a junkyard for all intents and purposes while the treaty was being signed, in fact. It didn't exist. 1930s is when the project started underway. When you plant trees, is it for that generation that is present, or who's it for?
Planting trees is for the generations afterwards and the multiple generations afterwards. It's not just about what's happening right then in the moment. It's basically a certificate of growth between the two parties involved. It's for the next generation and the generation after that. So I believe that in the planting of the cherry trees, it was sort of the U.S. saying, we want to cultivate a relationship with Japan. We want to cultivate a talking relationship with you, which obviously didn't exactly bode well for the World War II and the 1940s, but still.
Well, and that's I think, a testament to Japan as well. You know, it was the United States that, you know, basically kicked open the door.
In the 1800s.
Right.
They kicked open the door during the Meiji period, basically saying, we're here, we need you to open up.
Right.
And Japan before that was entirely isolationist.
Right.
Basically, they didn't want to be taken over like how China was during the Opium Wars with Britain.
Right.
Or like how the Philippines were and the Dutch Indies. They didn't want to be taken as a part of an imperialist culture, but the United States came up to them during the 1860s and was like, knock, knock, we're here, you need to open up your doors or we're going to fight you.
Right, and make you. And
yeah.
It seemed like the decision was made by Japan to say, all right, we'll do it, but we're going to be fantastic at it. We're going to like dedicate all of our energy to making ourselves. And so by the time you get to the early 21st century or 20th century, Japan's already in an expansionist war with Russia, and is like, and I always also point out to people that I'm like, Japan is has the second oldest baseball has been played there longest, only second to the United States.
United States, yeah.
Because part of that cultural export when relations were made was to bring baseball. And they, you know, and it's not the exact same game over there. They have their own modifications to it, but it's definitely a symbol in itself of that exact connection.
Yeah.
Jade, I really appreciate you stopping by and talking to me. And
thank you for giving me the opportunity. I'm really excited to talk about this kind of stuff.
I love broadening the idea of pop culture beyond just movies, TV shows, and games and things like that. Trees,
yeah,
you know, are popular culture, and you know,
yes,
they are.
Trees are a part of culture. So are other types of things, and like restaurants here.
Yeah,
is Nichinan the restaurant here, and then also different generations in and of themselves, the way that they learn, the things that they teach in schools, those are part of popular culture.
Yeah.
My Japanese teacher is, for me, a model of that because she learned about Portsmouth in school, and
that's so neat.
Portsmouth became a part of Japanese popular culture.
That's so cool. I love that. I think that's so neat to imagine that on the other side of the globe, people are spending a special attention to this place right here and holding it as, you know, an important thing for them. I think that's a cool thing. So thanks for adding to the concoction or your ingredients to my, I don't have chowder, but I have a pop culture concoction going on here. So I really appreciate you doing it. Thank you.
The date of this podcast publication is December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day. The relationship with Japan that was forged through the brokering of the Treaty of Portsmouth was non-existent for the 4 years that followed. The foreign policy of the Theodore Roosevelt administration arguably set into motion a series of events which prompted the Empire of Japan to carry out attacks on what Franklin Roosevelt would refer to as a day of infamy immediately after. John F. Kennedy served in the Pacific Theater during World War II, and 20 years later, as president, he was considered for the Nobel Peace Prize for averting a nuclear war during the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy was assassinated the following year in Dallas, but unlike so many presidents before him, was not brought home for burial, but laid to rest in Arlington National Cemetery. Arlington's command historian, Dr. Stephen Carney, joined me just this past weekend in Nashville during the National Council for the Social Studies annual conference. Take a listen as he explains the funeral's impact on popular culture.
I love having all the name tags because then it's like, well, Stephen.
Yeah.
This is Stephen Carney. He is from the Arlington National Cemetery. What is your title there?
So I'm the command historian at Arlington. So we're run by the Army. So just like any Army organization, we have a command structure for our history programs.
So I was just watching a documentary the other day about the Carlisle schools.
Yes.
And at Carlisle, there seemed to be somebody of the same position.
Yes.
There as well. And
yeah,
so,
correct.
Are you technically in the Army or are you...
I'm a civilian.
You're a civilian that's employed by the
employed
Army.
Employed by the Army.
Yeah. So Arlington National Cemetery is, and I was talking to your colleague a little while ago about its kind of its place in popular culture, that even though it's about, you know, 1860s is when it really started being used that way, it wasn't until 60 years ago that it really became part of the national lexicon as far as being what it is,
right,
actually.
Yeah.
Can you give us a little bit of background on that?
Sure. You know, I would say that prior to President Kennedy's funeral in 1963, the thing that made Arlington stand out from all the other national cemeteries that were around was that every May, we had, you know, decoration or a Memorial Day was held. And since that holiday was established in 1868, every year the official, you know, decoration or Memorial Day event is held at Arlington. So people recognized that there was something a little different or unique about Arlington, but the turning point was President Kennedy's funeral, because for the first time ever, the not just the American people, but the world got to see what a full honors funeral at Arlington really looked like and what that pageantry was. So it had a profound impact on the cemetery.
It kind of reminds me of what we learn about Queen Elizabeth II's coronation being the very first televised. So it's like, here's these things. In the case of that goes back centuries, that it's always been kept out of the public eye, but now is front and center. And I think, I mean, we might as well just use this question right here. Who is the intended audience or user of this? Maybe just up until that broadcast, give us a little bit about the, if you don't mind, just the background of how that property became a cemetery.
Sure.
And who, like, what the guidelines were to be interred there.
Yeah, absolutely. So the property that was owned by the Custis and ultimately the Custis Lee family, right, was seized by the Army on May 24th of 1861, just after Virginia seceded from the Union. And for the first 3 years or so, the property was used for fortifications, right, because it did defend Washington, D.C.
Right.
A freedman's village was established there for freed slaves that had made their way to, you know, U.S. lines somewhere around the D.C. area. But it wasn't a cemetery until the start of the U.S. Overland Campaign in May of 1864. Because the other national cemeteries that had been established in the D.C. area were basically full by that point, right? So during our early history, it was just casualties of the Civil War whose families could not afford to bring their loved ones home for burial, right? So that's who was being buried, you know, all 1864, 1865. After the creation of Decoration Day, and people start to look at Arlington as a little bit different, you started to see Civil War veterans who, you know, could be buried anywhere they wanted to be, actually now requesting to be buried at Arlington. But through like the Spanish-American War and even World War I, we mostly saw service members killed in action, you know, in Cuba, in the Caribbean, in the Philippines, who were ultimately brought back and buried at the cemetery. After World War I and World War II, actually, you know, families were given the decision to either leave their loved ones buried overseas at American Battle Monument Commission cemeteries, or to bring them back to the U.S. for reburial, and Arlington was one of those locations. But for the most part, our burials were generally those individuals killed in action. Sometimes you would see veterans, right, have some interest. But after President Kennedy's funeral, that was the turning point. You know, so at that point, we had a very large conscript army that had fought World War II, the Korean War. So there were a lot more people who were eligible for burial. And now there's this increased demand. So, you know, in 1963, the cemetery did about 1,000 burials. In the next couple of years, we were getting 12,000 requests per year for burial. So it really, it completely changed, you know, the nature of the cemetery.
Would you place it at the feet of mass media, basically?
Yes.
Before that, because I have this Life magazine here.
Yep.
You had the televised version of it. It was everywhere. People
yes.
saw that, and they just kind of recognized it for the first time ever. That's, and you know, I'm big on symbolism. I love symbolism. Washington, the city, has built-in symbolism. It was designed to be this, you know, reasoned, structured city, you know, rational lines, everything makes sense. That the National Mall has that symbolism of the Capitol opening up to the rest of the country, and the Civil War Monument, which I think was 1920s that the U.S. Grant won.
Right.
I always found that to be perfectly placed at the foot of the Capitol, facing out, like, saviors of the Republic,
right.
you know, the Union, and whereas Arlington, it wasn't intended to be that, but do you feel there is still some symbology of, like, these are the souls who sacrificed their lives for the Republic, and they're within reach of, they're within view of all these other heroes cast in
yes.
marble?
Yeah, so for sure. And, you know, part of the reason that George Washington Parke Custis, George Washington's step-grandson, when he inherited that property, he started to build the Arlington house on that ridge overlooking Washington, D.C., I think. So that was a very early attempt to make that connection okay. between the city and the property. But then when you go forward, so, you know, looking at this Life magazine and, like, the image on it that we recently did a tour for the 60th anniversary of the funeral. Mm-hmm. And we had a lot of people who attended that tour who told us, like, about their memories of seeing this on TV and how those images are still seared in their minds today. But when you look at President Kennedy's gravesite, right, it is perfectly aligned with the Memorial Bridge over to the Lincoln Memorial.
Oh, wow.
So I think there was a lot of effort on Mrs. Kennedy's part to ensure that, you know, that location at the cemetery was
in very
selected.
Short order too, because
very short
I mean
order.
Of course nobody expected him to be killed,
right,
and then he was, and then here is that I did not recognize that there was that direct line between
yes.
Lincoln and of course people have always made the two linkages between the two presidents for
yeah.
a lot of reasons.
Yes,
but there's just another
like they, yeah they get yeah that. And to your point about short order, you know, the New York Times reported on the night of the assassination, the 22nd of November, that the president was going to be buried at the Hollywood Cemetery in Brookline, Massachusetts, okay. where Kennedy's parents are buried, and then the two children. So Mrs. Kennedy had a stillborn daughter who was buried at that cemetery. And then, of course, tragically, Patrick died at a few days of age in the White House in August of 1963, so just a couple of months before President Kennedy's assassination. So really that decision to bury the president at Arlington was something that happened, you know, the night of the 22nd, the morning of the 23rd. You know, the Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, who's buried very close to President Kennedy now, went to the Kennedy family, specifically Sergeant Shriver, who was in charge of the Peace Corps at the time, and a Kennedy relative, and said, you know, the president belongs to the people. He should be buried somewhere that people
yeah.
can access him. So, yeah, so all of that, just in a matter of you know, 48 hours,
right.
It's kind of mind-boggling to think about.
I guess it says something definitely about the time period. The 60s were, I mean, that was such a huge, almost like a hinge time period of, like, moving things so much faster. Like, over your shoulder, I'm looking at a rocket ship.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
Yes.
That says it all for the 60s, and Kennedy himself.
Yes.
Like, that was really the futuristic vision. Everything was faster, everything was... And so,
yeah.
It is marvelous, it's amazing, but it fits the era pretty nicely that they would do that so
well. And, you know, when you mentioned mass media, the other thing that actually just occurred to me when you were saying that was, so in the 11 months or so after the president's assassination, over 7.5 million people visited the gravesite, which, you know, even for Arlington and you know, pre-COVID, the last time we were really coming up with solid numbers, we'd see about 4 million visitors a year. So in 11 months, you know, 7.5 million people coming. But think about air travel as well. You know, just another one of those. So commercial air travel all of a sudden becomes so much more accessible. And I think you saw, you know, that it wasn't just people from the local area now that were coming to pay their respects to the president, but people were flying in from around the country and around the world. Yeah.
Every time I've been to D.C., there's been, I run into so many people from all over the world who, you know, that's part of what you do when you come to the United States is to visit the Capitol. And it was almost like the creators of that city knew that ahead of time, like this is going to be less of a city, like an organically grown city that has, it's not going to really have much of a cultural scene for at least a while. It's just going to be like a congress of everything that the country has to offer just in one place. And you get to, I think one of the most remarkable, I think one of the first times I ever went to Washington, I loved how there's the U.S., it's like the National Modern Art Museum is right there in the mall.
Yes.
They have some really weird, you know, pretty out there, sometimes even like, you know, subculture type, right next to, as soon as you walk out, there's the Capitol.
Yeah.
You know, that's America. That's like, that's freedom right there, and we celebrate it. And the mall is ever growing. Arlington seems to, so the Iwo Jima Memorial, that obviously predates Kennedy.
Yeah.
Because that wasn't long after World War II, but that was, I always felt that that was actually a much more fitting, I know it's a very specific thing that it's recognizing, but to me that was, I like that one better than the official national World War II Memorial. I never really understood that one, why they separated by the states.
Right.
Because like shown in the the statue in the cemetery of this multi, you know, every guy in that photograph, and then the real guys who actually did, were from different walks of life, different parts of the country, Native American to, you know, people from New York. And, you know, it was a united effort. I never understood why they broke up the modern, you know, the World War One, like Utah, Nebraska. I'm like, we didn't fight that war as individual states. You could be in a regiment, you could be in a unit of, you know, just a company, a Texan, a Vermonter, or, you know, like everybody is working, and I just didn't understand that. Whereas the one in Arlington, because that's where they are.
Yes.
That's where, you know, they're still there. Yeah. And they're, is that why the soldiers from the Civil War, the veterans, because they wanted to be with their comrades?
Yeah, I think largely, you know, so a lot of those, the veterans that wanted to be buried at the cemetery, and I think you would include this, like, after the Spanish-American War and World War One as well, a lot of them were officers, and, you know, it was kind of like, so all of these soldiers or Marines or sailors that served under me who were killed in action, like, you know, there was that tie of, I want to be buried near them.
Yeah.
So I do think that was very compelling. But yeah, so to your point about the Marine Corps Memorial, you know, so Ira Hayes and Michael Strank are both buried at the cemetery, as is Rennie Gagnon. So, and of course the Marine Corps just a few years ago came out and said, while Rennie Gagnon was part of one of the flag raisings, it wasn't the flag raising that was captured, right? So, and the interesting thing about that is he's buried, Rennie Gagnon is buried most closely to the Marine Corps Memorial. And on the back of his headstone, he actually has a bronze plaque that depicts the flag raising, right? So that's an interesting primary source in itself.
I mean, you are surrounded by thousands of them at your workplace, and it's just, because even all those, the headstones that are almost identical to each other,
right,
the names on them are not.
Exactly.
Each name is a product of its time period. Yeah. You know, you have a lot more Wilbers and, you know, Homers and Georges and stuff from World War II than you would, you know, by the 60s and stuff. But, man, just bring up Ira Hayes. Here we are in Nashville. The Johnny Cash Museum is right across the street. I mean, we could do a whole podcast on Ira Hayes.
Yeah.
You know, that whole song. And then Flags of Our Fathers, the movie, that's where I learned about that. And, you know, you could treat that as a document of, was it 2005 or whenever? Like, why did they make that movie then? You know, obviously, if it was 05, then we're talking 60-year memorial since, you know, Iwo Jima. But it's still, it's like, why did you want to send that message at that time? Is it because this is a generation that's leaving us, and we got to recognize the real story before we just rely on the bronze, you know, or whatever metal they use?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, to tell that story. Because, yeah, memorials, monuments, they can teach us some things. But the thing that they mostly teach us is about the people who made them.
Right.
You know, and what they were all about. Yes. So I can't thank you enough for this wonderful conversation.
My pleasure.
And, yeah, it won't be long before I put it up there, because this is so relevant with the Kennedy. And his niece is speaking at this conference. So
yes.
That's an interesting tie-in.
And the last thing I would just say is, you know, we have a full range of educational materials that are available at Arlington National Cemetery, well, arlingtoncemetery.mil, right? Okay. So you can go to our website. They're all free. We have materials that teachers can use in the classroom if you're never, you know, able to make it to the cemetery with your students. We have all kinds of activities and tours for those who are coming to the cemetery on a field trip. So and our contact information is on there, so we're always interested and able to engage with school groups that reach out to us and let us know that they're coming.
Well, I just added a new website to my list of sources for my students.
Thank you so much.
Thank you again.
It was a copy of the December 6th, 1963 Life magazine that provided the basis for our conversation a few days ago. This issue contains many now iconic photographs, and you can see them by going to the Everything is a Primary Source podcast Substack at epspodcast.substack.com. And while you're on the web, check out everythinghistory.com. There you'll find all the information on my social studies consulting and podcast coaching opportunities, as well as links to all my social media accounts. And if you like what comes out of podcast karaoke, well, you can book a session for yourself and your next event right there. That's everythinghistory.com, everything-history.com. The last segment for today could find a home a few months from now on President's Day, as it is centered around George Washington himself. But as you listen to my conversation with Allison at the American Independence Museum from this summer, you'll hear at least one reason I combined it with this early December installation. So I'm here with Allison at the American Independence Museum in Exeter, New Hampshire, and from my table, it kind of looks like a yard sale, doesn't it? You know, with all my stuff everywhere. But you chose, I don't even know where I got these, but they've been in my kitchen forever, we don't use them, but you chose, who are these two people in salt and pepper shaker form?
One of them's George Washington, I think.
Yep.
And I don't know what the other person is.
That's his wife, Martha. And these came from, they have stamped on the bottom of them, Mount Vernon. Do you know where Mount Vernon is? That's his estate, his plantation. It's in Virginia. So if you wanted to visit George Washington, his gravesite, originally they were going to bury him, and he knew about this. It wasn't like they, you know, surprised him with it. But they were going, he was going to be buried beneath the Capitol building in Washington, which is the middle of the city. And he decided he'd rather be buried in his home, which is not terribly far from Washington, D.C. So we have a salt and pepper shaker, and I think the question that I'll choose for you, because you pointed out what it's made out of, so I'll choose the question of what material is it made from? So there's a couple of ways of looking at that, but when you pick these up, what material does it seem to be made out of?
Like glass?
Yeah, some kind of porcelain type, so it is breakable. Like if somebody were to shake the salt or pepper a little bit too hard, they might drop it and it'll shatter everywhere. But they are decorative. And the other way to look at it material-wise is, because if they're able to shape a salt and pepper shaker any particular shape, they based it on George and Martha Washington. So what does that tell you? And the date is stamped on here, 2007. What does that tell you about 2000, that time period, about 15, 16 years ago? What does the fact that they made these salt and pepper shakers, because in 2007, what could they have made them out of instead of that kind of material?
Maybe plastic?
Definitely. They wouldn't necessarily need to make them so nice. So why do you think that they, upped it just a little bit and used like the pottery type feel to it instead of just plastic?
Because George Washington and his wife were like alive a long time ago. And like they used, I think, a ton of glass in mm-hmm. the times that they were alive. So they wanted it to like go back to when they were alive.
Yeah, it maybe connect it a bit more to that time period. That's a good, definitely good theory, good hypothesis on it, because it would be kind of like chintzy in a way if it was made out of just plastic, right? It wouldn't come across as nice. Plus, they probably couldn't get as much money as I'm sure they charge for these salt and pepper shakers if they were just made out of plastic. What else? So these kinds of things, I know it says 2007 on it, but this kind of design was really popular in the first half of the 20th century. So people were, and using recognizable icons, pairs of things. So like around Christmas time, who do you think that they would make salt and pepper shakers out of?
Like Santa and like Mrs. Claus?
Right. Not it wouldn't be just like a person. It's always like a pair of people that are recognized. So they were like, okay, let's fill our gift shop. That's probably where these were being sold. Let's fill our gift shop with, because Mount Vernon now is kind of like this place where it's a museum. You learn about Washington. It's not a, doesn't function as anything else other than giving tours and things like that. So I'm sure they have more in their gift shop than just salt and pepper shakers. These are probably, I'm guessing, with some other similar type things. And the idea is that, it's like, oh, we have a pair of people. We can make a salt and pepper shaker. If it was just one person. And she's just as recognizable, I think, as Washington. Have you learned about George Washington in school?
No.
Not really? What do you know about him other than that he is either salt or pepper? I'm not sure which one goes with which.
I know that he fought in, what war was it again that we're here for? The Revolutionary?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was in the Revolutionary War. He went to like other people in the war's houses a lot.
Yeah, and everywhere he went after, because he was like the original American celebrity. He was really the only person in his time period that everybody in the country knew who he was. And building up that, because he had a lot of responsibility, because not only was he the commander of the rebel army, that revolutionary army, but because of that position, he was quickly against his own, he didn't really want to be this, but they elevated him to be like the father of the country. And when he became president, about 10 years after the war, he went on a tour of the country. And that's where a lot of those signs that you see, where like George Washington walked here, George Washington slept here, George Washington, he didn't actually shake people's hands. He usually bowed because he was kind of, he didn't like germs. They didn't know what germs were, but he was, against the, that idea. So he would like give a bow. George Washington bowed here. That came from him. That was intentional. He wanted, whenever he came to a new town, he would get out this uniform that he had from the war,
put it on, usually a couple miles outside of town, get back on his horse. Everybody recognized his horse as well. And he would trot into town, and everybody, oh, Washington's here, and they would go crazy. So, you know, this is, I would say, these things are kind of an extension of that, because the reason he wanted that so badly was to have a national unity, because, you know, as we were talking about before, hit record on this, with the states, you know, if you look at the states up and down the eastern seaboard, they're very different, aren't they? You know, here in New Hampshire, compare that with down in South Carolina. Have you ever been to a place like South Carolina before?
No.
Or Georgia? How far south have you gone?
I don't know, actually.
Florida, yeah. So, and you've been to Pennsylvania? Gettysburg is a... There's actually a George Washington connection to Gettysburg. Do you want to hear it real quick? There was some soldiers on that... during Gettysburg, and some of them were from Maine, that swear that they saw the ghost of George Washington ride on his horse in front of them right before the big battle continued on. And, you know, they swore up and down it happened. But even without that happening, there was a lot of George Washington imagery used on both sides of that conflict because of, you know, what he wanted to do when he was alive, and that was to be the uniting symbol of the country. So he's still doing that in salt and pepper shaker form, looks like. But so if you go to places like Gettysburg or Florida, definitely, you know, the farther south you go, you recognize just how different the states are from one another. But the idea that he was definitely in favor of is that despite our differences, we are all united in being American. And so he had a huge responsibility to do that as the first, the general of the country, and kind of like the first celebrity that the country ever had, the symbol of the nation. So would you have something like this in your house, do you think? Would you like to have the salt and pepper shaker? I'm gonna bring this pair back home with me, but is that something that you would think would fit in with yours or other households in the...
Maybe not my house, maybe another house, but not mine.
I feel like it's, there's different kinds of decorating that's popular nowadays. There's minimalist, which this wouldn't really fit in with minimalist, but then there's something called maximalist. Do you know what maximalist is?
No.
It's like, it looks like you walked into one of those junk stores or something, just everything everywhere. And I think this would fit in more in a maximalist setting than a minimalist setting. But, I think that's probably just enough school type talk for summertime, right? Thank you so much for stopping by.
I can't speak for the salt and pepper shakers, but the Washington Monument in D.C. was completed on December 6, 1884, and was the tallest building on the planet at that time. It, of course, can be seen in the background of several of the pictures from November 25, 1963. And to tie Washington back to the first segment, as I mentioned just now, the first president famously visited Portsmouth, New Hampshire during his tour of the states in 1788. That's it for this episode of the EPS Podcast, where everything is a primary source. We'll talk to you next time.